For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Yeah, I've been thinking about that passage in John 6, I think it is, where you said, Lord, the spirit that gives life, the flesh profits nothing. The words that I speak to you are spirit and are life. That's what we're banking on here tonight, Lord. That's why we're here. We're not here to impress anyone, to network or whatever. We're here to learn from you, so that you can change us into the people you made us to be. Have your way. Amen. All right, so I think what I'm going to do the next couple of weeks, few weeks, 2-3 weeks, whatever it is just teach various passages from the Gospels, either Matthew or Mark or Luke in this case. And so I thought that our home church has been studying through the Gospel of Mark. And I thought that I would go over a passage with you that we went over in our home church not long ago. It's one of those miracles that Jesus performed. A lot of you are familiar, perhaps, with his miracle in which he stilled the storm. And Matthew records it in Matthew 8. Luke records it in Luke 8. And Mark records it in Mark 4. We'll be looking at what Matthew and Luke's versions say, but we're going to work out of Mark. So just to give you a little bit of geographical orientation, this is the north part of Israel. And up there in the north part is, they call it the Sea of Galilee, but it's actually just a freshwater lake. It's pretty big. It's 8 miles wide at the widest point and 14 miles long at the longest point. And the action in this passage starts probably right here at Capernaum. Capernaum was Jesus' headquarters in the early part of his public ministry. And as you see, they're in transit from here, probably down here to Gergesa, where Jesus had an appointment with a demoniac. So we'll just read the story. It's pretty short. It says, on that day, this is after Jesus had given a series of parables about the kingdom of God. It says, on that day when evening came, he said to them, to his disciples, let us go over to the other side, of the Sea of Galilee. And so leaving the crowd, they took him along with them in the boat, just as he was. I don't know whether that means he didn't have time to pack a suitcase. It's just as he was. I want you to remember that. And other boats were with him also. And in transit then, there arose a fierce gale of wind, a fierce sudden squall. And the waves were breaking over the boat so much that the boat was already filling up. I don't know if any of you have been out on a big body of water in a bad storm. It's a terrifying experience. These men were fishermen. They knew this lake like the back of their hands. It was no problem for them to go across this lake, probably hundreds of times. But they ran into a storm. It's interesting. This is a picture of a part of the Sea of Galilee, and you can see that it's virtually ringed with high hills or low mountains. And that means that it lays down in a basin, and it's usually pretty calm. But what happens sometimes at nighttime is that cool air from the land will rush down through the ravines, in between the mountains, and that cold air then will collide with warm air rising over the lake, and the result is, they even have a technical name for it, this is these sudden severe storms. So this is still happening today, and that's what they ran into. So it says Jesus himself was in the stern, that's the back of the boat for you nautical people, and he was asleep on the cushion. We know, in fact, that boats back then did have an area in the rear where people who weren't rowing or weren't fishing could hang out. And they woke him and they said to him, teacher, do you not care that we're perishing? He got up and he rebuked the wind And he said to the sea, shut up. That's the original Greek. No, it's not. He said, hush, be still. And the wind died down and it became perfectly calm. This is the New American Standard. It's not really getting it here. The NLT says, and suddenly the storm ceased. I don't know. Have you ever? I have done something like this before, by which I mean I have like yelled at a storm, quit. Nothing happens. Nothing at all. I mean, can you just imagine what it would have been like for Jesus to wake up, wipe the sleep out of his eyes, face the storm and say, shut up? And what the language is indicating is that very instant, the wind stopped and the waves immediately subsided and they were staring in a matter of moments out over a calm Sea of Galilee. Wow. Then he turned and said to them, why are you afraid? How is it that you have no faith? It's an interesting question. We're going to come back to that in a little bit. And then it says they became very much afraid. This is a different word than the word afraid in verse 40. We'll come back to that too. Then they became very much afraid, or you could say they became very much in awe. That's probably better. They became very much in awe and said to one another, who the heck is this? That even the wind and the sea obey him. So the whatever fear they had concerning the storm was pushed out and replaced by this reverent fear, this awe for the power and authority of the person who was with them there in the boat. Who indeed is this person? This is one of a series of miracles that Mark narrates, and we're about five or six into it, where Jesus demonstrates his authority over demonic spirits, over physical sickness, and now over nature. And of course, the answer to this question Peter gives a little while later in Mark 8, where he says, you are the Christ, you are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. It's really even more than that, what they eventually realized is that the one sitting in the boat with them was God himself, God in a human body. Here's an interesting passage several centuries earlier that comes from the Psalms. What do you think about this? The waves rose up to the heavens and they went down to the depths. Their souls melted away in their misery. They reeled and staggered like a drunken man and they were at their wit's end. Who's that sound like? And then they cried to the Lord. That's the word Yahweh, the one true God, in their trouble. And he brought them out of their distresses. He caused the storm to be still so that the waves of the sea were hushed. It's almost a prophetic passage. It's a psalm several centuries earlier that's saying only God himself has the authority, the power to quiet the sea. And what we just read reads almost like this account revisited. By the way, some critics say, well, yeah, but this is a tall tale, this thing about Jesus stilling the storm. This is a legend that evolved, a story. Maybe he sneezed and 6 hours later the storm calmed down, but the story got embellished with the telling. That will not fly, because not only is Mark's gospel written at the latest 60 AD, which is only 30 years after this event, but even more importantly, Mark's gospel is the memoirs of the disciple Peter. We know that from early church fathers, that Mark wrote Peter's memoirs. And that's why we saw, I was kind of pointing out to you at the time, we saw these little details. Like, Why does he say they took Jesus just as he was? Because Mark, Peter remembered being there and thinking he just went. He didn't pack anything. Why does he say, and there were other boats with him? That's not really germane to the story. It doesn't count for anything. It's in there because Peter, when he told Mark about this, remembered, oh yeah, there were boats. There were other boats hanging around there. Why does he say not only that Jesus was asleep, but that he was asleep on the cushion? Why that detail? These are eyewitness details given to us so that we know that this account is, it's a historically accurate account of what happened. So anyway, the most obvious lesson of this passage we've already seen. It's Jesus demonstrating through this miracle his authority over nature, that he is the Messiah, that he is actually Yahweh, the Lord himself. But Jesus was a great multitasker. That's one of the things I love about Jesus. I love lots of things about Jesus. But one of the things I love most about Jesus is how, what a multitasker he is, how he gets so many things done in the same event. And he's multitasking here. He's not only proving to his disciples who he is, but he's also teaching them some very important lessons about what's involved in following him or being one of his disciples. And these lessons then apply to everyone in this room who's met Jesus, and they're going to apply to you if you wind up meeting Jesus. So I just want us to look at those. That's how we're going to spend most of our time. I see four lessons here that have to do with following Jesus. Here's the first one: that following Jesus does not mean immunity from storms. Right? I mean, you remember, how did they wind up in this storm? They wound up in this storm because Jesus is the one who said, okay, let's now go to the other side. And so let's go now and let's go this route. And so because they were following him, they ran smack dab into a life-threatening situation. And not only that, the reason why he said, let's go now from Capernaum to Gergesa is because he knew he had an appointment, as I said, with a man who was possessed by dozens of evil spirits. That's a terrifying situation, too. So if you follow Jesus, you're going to have, this is a physical storm, but there's something that's almost symbolic here. It's not truly symbolic. You're gonna get your world rocked. That's the way it is. And you know, the day is coming. It ain't here yet, but the day is coming when Jesus is going to return. He's going to return as the sovereign king that he is. And he's going to defeat all of his enemies. And he's going to bring true and lasting justice to this world. And he's going to heal all the brokenness in this world, including all the brokenness even in nature. And then there aren't going to be any storms. But until then, Jesus is continuing to do what he was doing in his public ministry. He was here invading this dark, broken world full of all kinds of fallenness and evil, and plunging right into it to rescue lost souls that he loves. That's what took him into this storm. That's what took him to the demoniac. That's what took him to the cross. And if you follow him, it's going to take you into that kind of stuff too. You just need to be forewarned. Not only will we not be exempted from the normal sufferings that come from living in this broken world? The last I checked, Christians get cancer just as often as non-Christians. Christians have car accidents just as often as non-Christians. Christians, the last time I checked, died like non-Christians. Right? So there's no exemption from the sufferings of a broken world. But in addition to that, he forewarns us there's going to be more. There'll be additional sufferings. There'll be additional discomfort as you sacrifice your comfort to follow him into needy lives. There'll be the heartbreak of being involved in people's lives that, frankly, you don't have to be involved in if you don't care. But if you care, you're going to get involved with people, and it's going to break your heart sometimes. You're going to get flack. You're going to get flack from a society, from a world system that Jesus says does not have any use from him. You're going to get flack from the evil one. Now, I'm not going to linger long on this point because I think it's pretty obvious, but, you know, there's a whole vein of pseudo-Christianity that are led by these healer dealers. And they tell you that if you really follow Jesus, you'll never get sick. They tell you if you really follow Jesus, you won't have any disasters or calamities in your life. And that is just the rankest kind of BS. It's not biblical. There's not a shred of biblical support for it, and it winds up misrepresenting Christ and dishonoring him when people in his name say that kind of stuff. So if you follow Christ, you don't get immunity from storms. They're coming. There's some good news, but first a little bit more sobering news. The second lesson that we learn in this passage is that storms, and I'm using that term figuratively, any adversity that you encounter because you follow Christ, that storms expose the littleness of our faith in Jesus. You remember that Jesus, after he stilled the storm, turned to them and said, "Why are you afraid?" It sounds like a stupid question, doesn't it? I'd be peeing my pants. Why are you afraid? Mark has it, "How is it that you have no faith?" And the way this is translated almost sounds like Jesus is saying, "You've got zero faith." That's not really what the Greek here indicates. And this is where comparing with other parallel accounts is helpful. In Matthew's gospel, he summarizes what Jesus said was, "Why are you terrified, you men of little faith?" In fact, in the Greek it reads, "Why are you terrified, you little faiths?" How'd you like to be called little faith? Oh, it could be worse. Luke summarizes his question as, "Where is your faith? You've got faith, but it's not in operation." Yeah, that's what adversity will do. You know, when you, some of you have followed Christ long enough to know that when things just seem to go well while you're following him, you can be under the illusion that your faith is really strong, and it could be weak, it could be withering, and you wouldn't even know it. When do you find out the true state of your faith in Christ? You find out in a storm. That's when you find out. Peter says in 1 Peter 1 that's the thing about trials. Trials are like fire working on silver, silver ore. And silver ore is laced with dross or rock that's useless and impure. And he says part of the value of trials is that they melt your faith like silver was melted, so that the dross becomes evident. And that's what's happening in this passage. How did Jesus know that they were little faiths in this situation, many faiths? How did he know that? He knew that evidently because of their reaction, which he observed with his own two eyes. They were losing it. The word here, afraid, is only used like three times in the New Testament. It's the word dilos, and it means to be terrified, it means to panic, it means to be cowardly. You know, fear in itself is a normal emotion when you're in danger. And in fact, certain kind of fear is helpful and important because it puts you on alert when you're in danger. But this word's much stronger. He's describing when fear controls you, takes you over so that your heart melts and even your thinking becomes irrational. And their thinking really had become pretty irrational here, isn't it? Because you remember what they said when they woke Jesus up? What'd they say to him? See, it's not on the screen, and you don't have your Bibles, and you haven't memorized the passage, so you don't know. What did they say? What did he say? They said to Jesus, "Do you not even care that we're perishing?" That's a sure sign that fear was paralyzing them and messing with their minds, because they had had all kind of evidence already how much he cared for them. Peter himself, whose memoirs these are, had seen Jesus come and save his mother-in-law's life right before his eyes. How's that for care? Unless you didn't like your mother-in-law. I guess it's open to interpretation. I'm kind of glad this is in here. Am I the only one in this room that gets so seized by fear sometimes that it's like controlling me? I don't think I'm the only one. And I've been following Christ now 44 years. And I just a couple of months ago had something happen in my life. Family crises really tear me up. And that's like having a massive storm in my boat. And we had a family crisis a month and a half ago. And I remember where I was when I heard what was going on. And I could just feel myself get physically sick to my stomach. I was unable to concentrate. All I was doing was painting my bathroom. I couldn't even get it together to paint my bathroom. I was just consumed by fear and these thoughts just drumming into my mind. Doom. This is going to happen. Then that's going to happen. Here's basically what began to overcome me. You're all alone. This is out of control. And nothing good can possibly come out of it. Has anyone else had those thoughts? Yeah. So this is a passage that you should be able to relate to. The storms that God allows to happen in your life as you follow Christ, one of the most important things they do is they expose the true state of your faith. That brings us to the third lesson, which is a little bit more positive. The third lesson is that Jesus responds to our little faith in him. I think it's pretty cool. They woke him. They're freaking out. They're mainly controlled by fear. And they say, "Teacher, do you not care that we were perishing?" We're perishing, but we have to give this to him, that they woke him up, right? They didn't just like lay down on the bottom of the boat and start moaning. They didn't jump overboard, right? They did come to him, right, for help, right? And so how did Jesus respond? This is part of the good part, right? Did he say, "Dude, you guys disgust me. You have such little faith. Forget it. I'm going to walk across the water to the shore. You're on your own." What did he do? Right? They had very little faith, but he still responded to the little faith that they had by stilling the storm. This is one of many times when you see this in the Gospels, especially in the Gospel of Mark. In Mark 9, Jesus and Peter and James and John come down from this mountain after having this amazing experience, and they go down. There's kind of like this passage. They come down, and here's this man who has a demon-possessed son who keeps throwing the son into fits and throwing him into the fire. It's not just like epilepsy, which can happen anywhere. It's always throwing him into fits and throwing him into harm's way. And so this man, this terrified man, comes running up to Jesus, and he says, "This is what's going on with my son. And I asked your disciples, the other 9 knuckleheads that were down here waiting for you, if they could do anything, and they couldn't do anything to help. So if you can do anything, then please help me." Jesus' initial reply sounds pretty hard. He says, "If I can, all things are possible to him who believes." Sounds pretty rough for a man in that position. And here's how that man responds. I love this verse, one of my favorite verses. He said, at that point, the man's father cried out and said, I do believe. Help me, help my unbelief. Isn't that an amazing statement? I do believe. I believe in you enough to come to you and ask you for help. I know there's all kind of unbelief or doubt mixed in with what little faith I have, and I want you to help me with that. Well, how does Jesus respond? Some of you know the story. He does not say, well, too bad, Buster. Why don't you go to seminary and come back when your faith muscles are a little bit stronger, and then we'll see what we can do for your son. It says that he cast the demon out of that man's son immediately and restored him fully to health and presented him to him. If you don't get anything else out of this teaching tonight, this is the thing that you really need to take home. The principle that we see in Mark 4 and again in Mark 9 and again and again and again, this principle, which it is that it is the object of your faith that is far more important than the strength of your faith. That's the principle, that the who you put your faith in, the trustworthiness, the power, the competence of the object of your faith, that's what matters way more than how strong your faith actually is. I mean, this is true in all kinds of areas of life. Just think if you tonight were seized by acute appendicitis. You know, that's when your appendix is infected and it balloons up, and if it ruptures, it could kill you dead. And, you know, you could have very strong faith in some quack guy who waves his hand around that area of your body without ever touching your body. And you might even get a little bit of what they call the placebo effect, where you might feel slightly better for a while because you believe that he's helping. But if that's all you did, you'd probably die within a few days. Because the object of your faith is incompetent, no matter how strong your faith would be in him. On the other hand, you could have your roommate take you to the ER, and they could present a competent surgeon to you, and you could be so scared that your hands were shaking so bad that you could hardly even sign the permission form. You could be freaking out as they were carrying you down to the operating room. You could be freaking out as until they gave you those good drugs before they knock you out. I like those. There's no conviction of the spirit because it's medicinal. But I'm digressing now. What would happen? What would happen if you had so little faith that you could barely get it together to sign the permission form, but that puts you in the hands of a competent surgeon? You'd come out healed and whole. Why? Because it's the object of your faith that counts far more than the amount, the strength of your faith. Man! This is like so important when it comes to becoming a Christian. Some of you in this room tonight have not yet become a Christian. And you may not even be all that clear about exactly what that means. Probably you know this. You probably know, if you're here tonight, that to become a Christian means for you to believe in Jesus. Right? The man in Acts 16 says to Paul, what must I do to be saved? How did Paul answer? Some of you know. Acts 16, 30, 31. What must I do to be saved? What did Paul say? Believe in the Lord Jesus Christ, and you shall be saved. Okay, now. Right there is a problem for, that was a problem for me. I learned through Dennis and my other ex-drug buddy who'd come to Christ, when they would talk to me, I'd say, do I have to quit getting high to become a Christian? And they'd say, no, you do not. All you got to do is believe in Jesus. I'd say, well, I noticed that you're a Christian now and you don't get high anymore. That's why I was wondering. And they'd be like, no, you come to Christ the way you are. You just need to believe. Even that bothered me, because then I'd go home and I would begin to think about, I don't know. I don't know if I could believe in Jesus the way they do. There was the key problem. Because they'd talk about their trust in Jesus to do this and that, and I was automatically comparing where I was at to the amount of faith that they already had in him, and feeling like, I just don't know that I could. In fact, I told one of them a few months later, I don't know that I could believe in Jesus as strongly as you do. Therefore, I don't know if I could become a Christian. You see the fallacy? What was I saying? That the strength of my faith in Jesus was more important than the object of my faith. Well, for me, I'm really, 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 really thankful that the Lord resolved this for me, because my life would be so, so much different in a bad way if he hadn't. One night, my girlfriend kicked me to the curb. I should have seen it coming. I was so stupid. I didn't see it at all. It totally blindsided me, totally devastated me. I came home. I was lying in bed. And I remember, because I was atheist, agnostic, whatever, I remember admitting to myself silently in bed, you don't have any idea what you're doing with your life. You just don't have any idea. You thought you knew, but you don't know. And the moment that I admitted that to myself, not to God, to myself, this verse, which is the verse that both of these guys, without knowing it, shared with me. This verse just came pouring into my mind. I had no idea where it was in the Bible, but I knew it was in the Bible. A lot of you know this verse. Look, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice, if you hear my voice and you open the door, I will come in. That's about all I knew. I didn't know the rest. And that's what arrested me, because in that moment, as I lay there in my bed, I thought, I think I could open the door. It's not hard to open a door. Doesn't require a lot of faith to open a door. So here was my prayer. Jesus, if you exist, I want you to come into my heart, into my life. And if you will do that and show me that you're real, then I'm going to be willing to follow you. You see, there's so little faith there. So little faith. And yet that was enough. And nothing like, you know, dramatic happened. I didn't hear cymbals crashing. I did not have some dramatic emotional experience, as God grants to us when we open the door to Christ exactly what he knows we need. And what I can say is that when I woke up the next morning, I was still very depressed that my girlfriend had left me. And yet, side by side with it, was something there that was not there the day before. I can only describe it as a sense that that I had made the right decision, a sense that was sort of like, almost like I'd come home. And then things progressed from there in a very uneven way, especially for the next year. But you get the point that I'm making. My faith was so small, so weak, and yet the living Christ was the one who, he's the one who put that verse in my mind. He's the one who was summoning me. And all it took was just saying, if you exist, I want you to come in. That's all it took. And as I said, you all know this, even as young as you are. You all know that you make these decisions in life. And a lot of times we're making decisions and we don't really realize how significant they are at the time. But then later we look back and realize, oh, that was way more significant than I thought. Usually we see it because it's bad, right? Oh, can I just tell you this decision here? There's not a week that goes by in my life 44 years later that I don't look back on this decision and remember it. And it's like this, the significance of this decision just keeps growing like this massive mountain. Bigger and bigger. The ripple effect for good in my life just keeps getting bigger and bigger. And it blows my mind that Jesus Christ would pour so much goodness in my life because of such a decision that was so weak in faith. So my word to you here tonight, and you know who you are because I believe the living Christ is speaking to you right now through me. All the faith you need tonight to meet him and to have your life changed forever is to say, Jesus, if you exist, I'm opening the door to my heart right now and I'm asking you to come in. You'll have to show me from there. He will do that. He will do that. And you will be looking back in a very short time and realizing, wow, it's true. The object of my faith was way more significant than the strength of my faith. This is also true, a very important principle when it comes to following Christ. And I'll just say a couple of words about this. When you meet Christ, when you receive Christ, and then you begin to follow him, you're going to, as I've already said, we see in this passage, you're going to run into storms that freak you out, and they're going to expose the littleness of your faith, and you're going to find Satan then coming to you and accusing you about the littleness of your faith, trying to get you to feel guilty about how many doubts you have, how you don't have faith as strong as so and so. And it's all from the evil one to try to get your focus onto the deficiencies in your life to accuse you rather than to get your focus on, I'm going to hang in there with Christ the best that I'm able. You just remember that. Well, many years ago, a Christian author named John White, we still sell a lot of his books because they're so good over there at the bookstore. The Fight, The Cost of Commitment, The Golden Cow, Eros Defiled. He came and visited us back in the early 80s. And he was staying at my house, and I was up late with him one night, and he was saying, you know, what are you wrestling with as a leader in this church? And I just said, John, I'm so ashamed because I feel afraid so much. You know, I feel afraid before I get up to teach. I feel afraid every time some big decision comes up that we got to make that I know is going to be unpopular. I'm ashamed of how afraid I am. And he said to me, he had this British accent, which I'm not able to emulate, but he said to me something that really helped. He said, Gary, it's not a sin to be afraid. It's only a sin to take the counsel of your fears. You should worry way less about the fact that you're afraid and just focus on whether you're on taking Jesus' counsel. That's all that matters. Well, that took such a load off of me. And maybe it'll take a load off of you even tonight. Well, there's one more lesson, and I wanted to save. I've tried to kind of manage the time so we can spend a little bit more time on this one. I think in many ways it may be the most important one. The fourth lesson that Jesus is teaching us in this passage is that he's challenging us to overcome fear with faith. This is not contradictory to what I just said. He will respond even to our little faith, just as he did with them, and yet, you know, toward the end of the story, he does come around to this, where he asks them, why are you so afraid? In other words, the implication here is that your faith can grow. And as your faith grows, your fears will diminish. Now, I want to be very clear. I want you to hear me very clearly. There is no one in this life, no Christian, no matter how gifted, no matter how mature, etc., who's not going to continue to battle with fear. There's just too many reasons why that's the case. Having said that, it is possible to gain a growing freedom from fear, to experience in an ongoing way less and less enslavement to fear, less and less crippling anxieties, and to be undergirded, as Paul says, more and more by a freedom from fear. That is part of the deal for those who follow Christ. And he's hinting at this here. He's saying, if your faith grows, then you'll fear less. I've been recurrently arrested by this, because even by my family history, has a real history of anxiety. My dad was a terrible worrier. His mom was. I can see it in my family, and I wrestle with anxiety. And so I feel like I've been in school on this for the last decade, asking the Lord, how can I have greater freedom from fear and anxiety? And the Bible's answer to that question is really rich. You'd be amazed to know how much the Bible has to say about this issue here. And what I just want to do is distill for you what I think are the four main answers that the Bible gives to this question. How can we become more free from fear? Here's the first one. You're going to have to admit that you're afraid. You're going to have to admit your fears. John Stott, maybe the greatest Bible teacher in the last half of the 20th century, said this. He said, fear is like fungus. It grows in the darkness, but it shrivels in the light. There's a lot of wisdom there. When you have fear in your heart and you just repress it, when you just keep it secret. And a lot of us learn to do that because when we grew up, there was no one there to help us with our fears anyway. So you just manage it the best you can by just repressing it, trying to push it out of your mind. When you do that, all that happens is that those fears go collect in your soul and they build up, and they're going to come out sideways in bad ways by anxiety episodes or depression or other things. Admit your fears. Bring them out into the light, because, and when I say admit them, I mean admit them especially to God. Have you ever heard the word supplication? It's one of those biblical words. It's like, we don't use that because it sounds weird, but it's a pretty important word. Supplication simply means that form of prayer where you, in an unvarnished, raw way, just pour out your soul to God. The junk, not just the good stuff. And the model here for this in the Bible are the many supplication psalms. There's several dozen psalms where really what's going on is that the psalmist to God, but of course he's doing it in the hearing of the readers, is just pouring out, here's what I'm terrified about. So you should do that. Some of you are like real macho, like, you know, I don't ever admit I'm afraid because I'm cool. And you're a fool. You're not cool, you're a fool if you do that. Especially when you don't even need to do that and it doesn't work. Those are two really good reasons for dropping that habit like a hot rock. A lot of times what you're going to need to do in addition to admitting to God when you're terrified in prayer is that you're going to need to grab a friend and you're going to need to confide in them and say, I am terrified because of this. I know it doesn't make sense. I feel even embarrassed telling you, but here it is. Blah. Sometimes it's remarkable how that in itself brings sanity back into your heart and mind. So you got to admit your fears. Secondly, and this is probably the most important. I don't know. They're all really important. You're going to have to choose by an act of your will against your feelings to recall and to say to yourself, really, and to affirm by faith promises that God makes that are relevant to your fear. And oh my God, are there a boatload of promises related to your fears. Did you know this? Did you know that? Do you know what the most frequently issued command in the Bible is? And it's not even close. Does anyone know? Don't be afraid. Which is not really a command. It's more like, it's like, don't be mad. Don't be afraid. It's like, you don't need to be terrified. You know how many times? You know how many times? 366. That's like Clive Calver, when he showed me that, he said, that's like one for every day of the year plus leap year. Now, what does it tell you? What does it tell you that God 366 times in His Word tells us you don't need to be afraid? It tells you that God knows fear is our biggest problem. And did you know that almost every single time that God says that, the reason that He gives for why we don't need to be afraid is the same? What's the reason? Because I am with you. And a lot of these other promises, there's the verbiage that surrounds those passages where it's basically saying you don't need to be afraid because I'm with you. Those are promises from God. They're inspired by God Himself, recorded for you and me. They're living and active because they're like when you are afraid and you admit to God, I'm terrified, then these promises have the power to bring you back to sanity and to move you forward. 42 years ago is when I began to teach the Bible, and God put on my heart, this is what I want you to do for life. So I had taught maybe 5 Bible studies in the previous year, most of them pretty bad, frankly. And then in fall quarter of that year, my junior year in college, I was teaching 3 Bible studies a week on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday morning. And I was so stupid that instead of doing the same teaching 3 times, I decided to teach 3 different books, Philippians, Colossians, 1 Thessalonians. Well, I am here to tell you that I became so fearful that by the middle of the quarter, I was literally puking my guts out Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday morning, either before I taught or right after I taught. Because I was so anxious. I couldn't sleep those nights before. And God gave me a promise then that saved me. And that has been a go-to passage for me over and over since then. And this is the passage. I'll put it up there. But I know it. I think I know it. But you, O Lord, are a shield about me, all around me, my 360 shield. My glory. And the one who lifts up my head, the one who is able to lift up my downcast head. I was crying to the Lord with my voice, and He answered me from His holy mountain. So I lay down and slept. And I awoke, for the Lord sustains me. So I will not be afraid, even though 10,000 men set themselves against me round about. Can I tell you that? That quarter, this is what I said over and over on my bed until I fell asleep, night after night after night. And that's what saved me through that quarter. And the many, many times in my life since then, when I have been terrified, including that family crisis a month and a half ago, this is not like some magic pill. It's like you say to God, I'm terrified and it feels like my life is falling apart because of this or that, whatever it is that you need to admit. And then you say, but you say, and then you just start saying back to God what He says. And when you say it, like this passage, then you say, and Lord, by faith, I choose to believe that what you say is what's true. And then it depends. I mean, sometime a month and a half ago, I walked around the block recurrently and just went over this passage with Him probably 2 dozen times until my feet began to come back underneath me. This is not sexy. It's taking the promises of God and choosing to utter them back to God. I feel, but you say, I affirm that what you say is true. What are your promises that you have? Do you have promises of God that speak directly to the fears that come after you? Better get some if you don't have some. Best way to get some is to talk to one of your friends here and say, what promises really are minister to you when you're afraid? It helps to remember previous examples of God's faithfulness. It's a big theme in the Bible. This is also one of the great benefits of walking with God over a longer and longer period of time. You begin to have your own history with God, where you have seen Him come through and deliver you from very bad situations and different kinds of situations. And eventually you get to the point where it's seldom that you have a storm that you haven't been through something like that before. And so it's super important then to choose to remember how God came through for you in a similar way before, to play it back, to thank Him. I remember how you did that, and I know because of your word that you're going to do that with this situation as well. So I'm going to thank you in advance for how you're going to get me through this and move me forward and increase my faith through this. Thank you. Sometimes you've never been through a certain. There's a lot of storms that you got ahead of you that you'll never have been through anything like before. And even in those cases, it can be very helpful to remember storms that were very different, but that had the same outcome. God came through. If He could come through in this thing, putting my life together after my parents got divorced or whatever it is, then I bet he can get me through this, whatever it happens to be. And then lastly, and very importantly, in this area of overcoming a slavery to fear, is we need to be willing to step out in faith to actually do the will of God that lies right in front of us. Peter says in 1 Peter 4:19, let those who suffer according to the will of God, let those whose boats are rocking because you're trying to follow Christ, let them entrust their souls to a faithful Creator in doing what is right. That means by doing, what is the thing? And it's usually one thing. What is the one thing that you see God would have you step out in faith and do in spite of your fears? That's a very, very, very important point. A lot of us make the mistake of saying, God, when you free me from the feelings of fear, then I'll step out to act on what you say. And yet, sometimes He does that just in His mercy. But in the vast majority of cases in my life, the situation will be there. The boat is rocking. The water is coming over the boat. I am admitting my fears to God. I'm holding on to Psalm 3, for example. I'm remembering how He got me through. And it's like, but I'm still afraid. And He's like, yeah, but I want you to do this. And most of the time, the deliverance from fear and even the situation itself comes after you act. It's just the way it works. If you live your life basically obeying your fears, they'll slowly kill you. One of my friends has a boa constrictor, and I watched him crush a mouse last year. Or it was a rat, I think it was. You know how they do that, right? They put their body around whatever it is they want to kill. And I think what happens is they suffocate them. And I think the way it works is every time that animal exhales, the coils get tighter, tighter, and tighter until they suffocate them, until they crush them. Now, why am I talking about this? Because that's what fear will do with you. Fear, every time you give way to your fear, the coils get tighter. And I'm here to tell you, I know a lot of people my age who are totally crippled by fear. They live their entire lives, Christians, their entire lives, crippled by fear, because for so long they have obeyed their fear. So you've got to have a category. And again, the key here is, Lord, what is the one thing that you want me to do in this situation? Not the 12 things. What's the one thing? You know, it may be that he's calling you to give up something that you know is outside of his will, like a sexually immoral relationship. Like, what's the one thing? It may be that it's taking that one step to open your mouth to bring up something difficult that needs to be said to someone. You know, just one sentence that you need to say. It may be that you know that he has a person in your life who is lost. And you know that he wants you to ask them what they think about Christ. And you know it's scary because they bit your head off. What's the one thing that he wants you to do? And you take that step. And usually what happens is that you get the power of God coming into the situation, and the peace of God begins to guard your heart and mind. And more importantly, one more part of your history where you've seen this is really true, that as I'm willing to walk through this with God, then he's going to grant me greater freedom from fear in my life. Anyway, we don't need to read that. That's all I got. Those are the lessons that we learn from this little event in Mark 4. What do you got? You got some questions? That you guys use mics, right? When you do questions, we'll start with old Pat, right there. Young Pat. I'm old, you're young.
I don't know if this is on or not.
It's on.
Okay. I guess I was noticing your whole point about the object of faith being so critical and how in our society right now, it is the opposite.
Yep.
Because what we, or at least what we're told to value, is sincerity.
Yeah.
Which, and in fact, in many of, you know, sincerity is valuable even when we think there's nothing there at all. And so I think that's kind of striking. And in particular, it's also striking because one of those two options puts the control in our hands. Mm-hmm. And that's the one that, of course, that's the sincerity one, that we basically, something about us is what matters, and that if there is a God or something out there, that he'll be just so happy with what we bring.
Yeah.
And I think that the Bible is so cool in the way it just turns that right on its head and puts everything right back into God's hands and into his lap.
And it may be the sincerity thing or the strength of my faith is appealing to us because of our pride. We just think, you know, well, yeah, because that makes me cool, and yet that brings such a weight with it. And God's like, no, who I am and what I say is what matters. You play a very little role just in aligning yourself with who I am, and it really takes the pressure off. Yeah, great point. Okay, red shirt, backwards ball cap. What's your name?
My name's Kyle.
Kyle?
Yeah.
All right.
So last week I lost my grandma, and it's been a very scary time for me. But like what you're saying earlier, and I really like your point where it's like fear isn't a sin, and it's okay to, like, to feel scared. It's like what you do with that.
That's right.
And I think like through this past week it's been, you know, at the end of the day, you're scared because, like, I don't have, like, the faith that I want. Like, I don't have that strength of faith that, you know, she's okay and all that stuff. But I think it's been really cool because I've been taking those, like, little steps, and it's been really helpful because, like, every single day, like, I keep on looking back on it and knowing what God says about death and how we can be reunited with him.
Yeah.
And all that has been really helpful every day, like, getting through it and having my strength and faith grow every day too, where it's been like, it's hard now, but every day it's getting a little bit better.
That's great. And praise God that you can say that, because so many people in our culture, when they lose a loved one, there's just nothing. I praise God that you can see him at work through that. Yeah. Over here, we'll be sectionally equitable. one of those two along the aisle. Maybe you're wondering what I just said. We're going to get questions from each section. That's what I said.
Sorry. I really loved your teaching. I really appreciated it because everybody who knows me knows that one major thing I struggle with is fear. And, I mean, everybody does, but it tends to be kind of crazy. I think, like, what's really cool is, like, from what you've been teaching and what you've been going through is something that, like, God has been actually showing me, which is amazing because it's, like, with the fear, what comes from that a lot of times for me personally is feeling ashamed and feeling guilty because it's, like, shouldn't I trust God? It's, like, shouldn't I be able to do these things?
Right. Take it to that slide on the keep going. I'm real sorry, but I'm just bringing the content back up.
Cool.
So you go right ahead.
Something that I've actually been actually really grateful for is that your comment of one of the things to learn is that how Jesus responds to our little faith in him. Mm-hmm. And how, like, even though I do feel afraid and even though I can feel ashamed or whatever, it's like I can actually approach God and ask him to convince me of his love and that he cares for me. And it's really cool to actually see God respond to those, like, desperate acts of, like, asking him for that. It's like, I know that you're capable of this, and it's like, but I'm just afraid and I'm not sure.
Yeah.
And it reminds me of Romans 8:32, where it says, he who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for all of us, how will he not also, along with him, graciously give us all things? And it's just like, a lot of times when we need something or want something, we are afraid, and sometimes that stops us from asking God for anything.
Yeah.
But it's like, but God, who's already given us the greatest thing of all, it's like, what else would he want to withhold from us? And it's like, it's all because he loves us, and it's all because he cares about us, and it's like, he wants us to know that. It's like, that's what he wants us to be convinced of. It's like, so that way, it's like, do not be afraid, because I'm with you, because I love you.
Yeah.
And it's just amazing how little we can believe that, and how if we just desperately try to cling on to God and just try to do that, it's like, he definitely comes through and tries to convince us of that.
And maybe that's part of what Jesus means when he says that unless we become like little children, we're going to have trouble with the kingdom. Because, there's one of the things about little children is that they when they're afraid, they're not cool yet. They come to someone that they think can help, and they say, I'm afraid. And so I think that's part of the childlike faith that he doesn't want us to grow out of. Yeah. Back there? In the back, red?
Yeah, I just wanted to connect points 3 and 4, that to be able to overcome fear, it seems like what's most important is the object of your faith. And just being a psych student at OSU, positive psychology is kind of a trend right now. And I don't think it's proving to be successful because people are just trying to tell themselves, you know, good things are going to happen, you know, and they may believe that in some way, but it doesn't last. That doesn't bring about change, because in the end you have that fear there that's like, well, why should they work out?
Right.
Why should things happen? Why does the world want to do something good for me? And for a lot of us who have been through a fair amount of life, you know, we know that the world is not out to help us.
Yeah.
But being able to come to a personal God who has the capability and who has, the intentionality to care for us, that is something that I've experienced and that I've seen in a lot of people can really, like you said, set us free from a lot of fears that rule our lives.
When we were in college, there was the thing that was like what you're describing was called positive thinking, the power of positive thinking. And I remember really just getting pissed off about that as a young Christian, because I'd be walking back from class to my car my freshman year, and I'd turn the radio on. It would always be the same guy, you know, talking about the power of positive thinking, because it was like it's all hanging in midair here. And the unfortunate part is when people buy into that positive thinking, or what you called positive psychology, eventually it leads to cynicism. It either leads to nuthood, you just don't live in the real world, or you wise up and you become cynical, because now you got to protect yourself by seeing through everything. And the only alternative that exists is to know the one true God and how he's revealed himself, and to have an actual relation, a love trust relationship with him, who is the rock. Like David's, you're my rock, you're my fortress, you're the one I can rely on, your words. All right, we need to probably pray. That'd be good. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Lord, your word says faith comes by hearing, hearing by the word of Christ. Somehow your word has the ability to stimulate our faith. And I just want to pray for myself and for the other folks in this room who are following you, that you would help us to memorize your word. Help us to memorize the words of specific passages and promises. Help us to speak them back to you, affirming them by faith. And I just want to pray also, Lord, for the people that are here tonight who maybe haven't met you yet, that tonight would be the night where they would just say, I don't have much faith, but the faith that I have, I'm using right now to open that door. Come on, come on in, Jesus. We know that you're going to answer that, and it's going to be good. So we thank you for that in advance. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.